Hello everyone, welcome to the reading of the Ford Dodge Messenger. We're reading from the editions of Friday, February 26th, Saturday, February 27th. I'm Kevin Rogers at the microphone. Glad to have you listening as always. Reading on a Sunday afternoon, it's mostly cloudy and it's a breezy day. We've got some terrific temperatures coming up, at least in the Ford Dodge area, over the next week with no precipitation in the forecast, and we'll talk about that a little bit later in our time together. Peaceful march was held at Butler Elementary School as Butler Elementary celebrates Black History Month. Words like unity and love were written on posters held by students in all grade levels at Butler Elementary School Friday. The students held the signs high and proud as they marched in and around the school with them. Upbeat music, such as Michael Jackson's Man in the Mirror, played through the school speaker system. Razaria Parker, a 9-year-old fourth grader, held a sign that said, "All Lives Matter." Braden Weiss, an 8-year-old third grader, had the words, "Love Everyone," written on his sign. The peaceful march was a culmination of the work students had put in during the month. Those lessons while also talking about African American heroes and historical figures, she said. The kids have really embraced it. They have enjoyed learning about it, not only during SEL time, social emotional learning, but all throughout the day they will talk about it. Kayla Roberts, school counselor, said for each week during the month of February, students learned about a famous African American, Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King Jr., Ruby Bridges, and Harriet Tubman, were among the famous African-American figures students learned about. The school also created a video where students shared what they have learned. "We polled a student from each grade level to talk about what Black history means to them," Roberts said. Some of the things students said in the video included things like treating everyone fairly and not judging people by the color of their skin. Roberts said students have been able to differentiate between slavery and segregation. Students have also learned how civil rights activists have contributed to the rights enjoyed by Americans today. Robert said the march was a way to reward students for their learning while also making the lessons hands-on. "We had them make posters and march and show their representation on how they would contribute to Black history," Robert said. Burrell said the students were looking forward to the march. "They looked forward to this all week. Students were proud to make their posters and proud to march. One of the biggest lessons students are learning is how important it is to treat others with respect. They learned about stop racism and love all," Burrell said. In terms of the signs students created, Burrell said it had to be something they believed in and could stand by, reflecting on all the things they'd learned this month. Burrell considered the day a success. "There is something I hope we can continue to do every year." Back to the main page of the Messenger. Waiting for my computer to... Bill, that'll be the next article that we read in the Messenger today. "A bill that would reduce early voting in Iowa will become a model for the rest of the nation," State Senator Tim Kramer said Friday. "We will find other states that will follow what Iowa has done," the Fort Dodge Republican said during an Eggs and Issues forum. State Senator Jesse Green, Republican of Harcourt, also commented on the measure during the virtual question and answer session. "The worst form of voter suppression is voter fraud," he said. State Representative Ann Meyer, Republican from Fort Dodge, did not comment on the voting legislation. Instead, she talked about bills she wrote to improve child care that had been passed by the House of Representatives. Meyer also talked about some bills aimed at increasing the number of physicians and other health care providers in rural Iowa. Eggs and Issues, a monthly event during the legislative session, was forced online by the COVID-19 pandemic. It is sponsored by the Greater Fort Dodge Growth Alliance and Iowa Central Community College. The voting bill, championed by legislative Republicans and derided by the Democratic counterparts, would do these things: reduce the number of early voting days from 29 to 20, close the polls at 8 o'clock for every election, require absentee ballots to arrive before the polls close in order to be counted, creates the option to charge county auditors with a felony if they do not follow the instructions of the Secretary of State. The measure was passed by both houses of the legislature this week and was sent to Governor Kim Reynolds. Crane Brink said it is the third modification to Iowa's voting laws in recent years. He said every time on one of these election law changes has passed, it has been criticized as a voter suppression tactic, something that hurts disabled voters and is racist. But there has been record voter turnouts in each of the last three general elections, he added. Every time more people are voting, he said. Every change we have made it better, Crane Brink said. Meyer has introduced a bill to eliminate what she has repeatedly called the cliff effect for child care assistance. That cliff effect happens when a parent reaches a certain wage level and all their child care assistance is taken away all at once. Her bill would gradually ratchet down the amount of child care assistance as wages go up. She also introduced a bill that would increase reimbursement to child care providers who accept the state's child care assistance money. Both measures have passed the House and have been sent to the Senate. Because young doctors and other health care providers with Iowa connections are more likely to stay in Iowa, Meyer is working on some bills aimed at helping that happen. She said one bill would require the 75% of students admitted to the medical and dental schools at the University of Iowa be Iowans. The other bill would guarantee that every recent medical school graduate with Iowa connections gets at least an interview with residency programs in the state. Residency is the next stage in a doctor's training after medical school. Reynolds has sent the lawmakers a major piece of legislation intended to increase the amount of ethanol used in the state. Green said it is a really big bill that will have to be changed a lot in order to pass. One problem with the bill, he said, is the time frame it calls for. For instance, he said the bill envisions having all fuel pumps able to handle higher blends of ethanol by 2025. He said that is not logical. He said the bill would provide $15 million for a program to help gas stations purchase the equipment needed to dispense higher blends of ethanol. It should begin to help retailers improve their infrastructure, he said. Heading back to the main page of the Messenger, Ready to Roll is going to be the title of the next article as we share the Messenger together. Robots will take over Fort Dodge Senior High School on Saturday. Well, kind of. The Fort Dodge Senior High Robotics Club is hosting the first Tech Challenge League Championships today, with 21 other high school robotics teams competing virtually due to the coronavirus pandemic. From senior high, there will be Team 7332, or Dodgerbot, which is comprised of mainly experienced upperclassmen. The other Fort Dodge team is Team 10185, or from the Island of Misfit Robots, which is mainly newer, less experienced students. Other local schools competing include Humboldt, Manson, Northwest Webster, and Southeast Valley. The students on the teams have been preparing for this tournament since the beginning of the school year, when they built their robots from the ground up after learning what the year's game is from First Tech Challenge, so they can build a robot that will work for those specifics. At senior high, the students stay after school whenever they can to work on perfecting their robot and coding, sometimes staying as late as 9 o'clock, said Dodger Bot team member Elijah Yates, a junior. In the week before the championship, the Dodger Bot team is focused on programming for its autonomous component of competition. The biggest thing we normally do is we put something on, then we sit and make revisions until it's how we want, and then we add something more, explained team member Matt Jass, a junior. Overall, the team was feeling pretty confident about their preparedness for the league championships, noting their consistent performances this season and that they're currently ranked fourth in the league. On Monday, the team was also working on shooting rubber rings into a target, which helps add points during matches. The problem they were running into was trying to get the robot to pick up the rings off the ground to give them more chances to shoot, since the robot can only hold 3 rings at a time. Without shooting, most matches will end up getting 75 points, Jass said. That's going to be the Dodgers' bot's X factor today. Many other teams competing don't have working shooter functions on their robots to rack up extra points. During competitions, the robots complete games in a 12x12 foot arena. The first part of the game is a 30-second autonomous period where the robot completes tasks that it is programmed to do by the students, like using a sensor to hit certain things or move components into boxes on the floor to score points. Following that, there is a driver period where a student, quote, drives the robot using a remote and has it pick up discs off the ground to shoot at a goal. The end game gives points for the robots picking up wobble poles and placing them outside the arena. The robots are made each school year by the students themselves using a basic robot kit and adding components and circuitry as needed to attain the final model envisioned by the team. One feature of this year's robots are the Mechanum wheels, which allow the robots to move forward, backward, and sideways without ever having to turn. All that building, coding, and tinkering has led to today, the league championship, said senior high industrial technology teacher and robotics club advisor Ed Berkey. They have to interview with a panel of judges in the morning, and then we're going to do 6 matches, and they take their scores on those and turn those in. What happens is the judges get together and decide which team looks good for what awards. The top 12 teams from today's league championships will move on to the Super Qualifier tournament held at Lamar's on March 27th. The top finishers at the Super Qualifier will advance to the Iowa Championship in late April. The awards ceremony for today's championship is to start at 5 o'clock on Sunday and can be seen on YouTube. Heading back to the main page of the Messenger for our next article. And some Northwest Webster schools will hold a special election coming up. Click, 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 he said as he clicked on his mouse. Voters in the Manson Northwest Webster Community School District will be asked to raise and extend the voted physical plant and equipment levy on Tuesday during a special questions on the ballot, the first asking to raise the voted PEPL rate from 83 cents to $1.34 per $1,000 taxable value for the remainder of the current PEPL period, which expires June 30, 2022. The voted PEPL is extended in 10-year periods, and the next extension will run to June 30, 2033. So the second question asks to raise the PEPL rate from 83 cents to $1.34 per $1,000 taxable value for that period. The PEPL is a voter-approved levy that serves as the primary revenue source for funding of school infrastructure, equipment repairs, and purchases. According to the Manson Northwest Webster District, raising the voted PEPL by 51 cents will not increase the total tax rate for its residents. The district plans to decrease the rate of other categorical funds like the general fund, management fund, and regular PEPL fund to offset the increase in the voted PEPL fund. If the voted PEPL increase is approved by voters next week, the district plans to hold a community strategic planning session to gather input from staff, students, school board members, and community members to develop a 5 to 10 year facility improvement plan. Some of the district's priorities are adding new classrooms at the junior senior high school, updating electrical services at both buildings, renovating the old bus barn, replacing playground equipment at the elementary school, and more. The full list of priorities may be found on the district's website at manson-nw.k12.ia.us. Voters living in the Webster County portion of the Manson District will vote at the Clare Community Center at 520 East Front Street in Clare. Voters living in the Calhoun County portion of the district will vote at the MAC Center, 1227 16th Street in Manson. Polls open at 7 o'clock a.m. on Tuesday and are open until 8 o'clock p.m. on Tuesday. Clock tower repair continues at the Webster County Courthouse. Picture in the paper shows the top of the dome of the Webster County Courthouse clock tower sitting high above Fort Dodge. The new finial at the top was recently installed as part of that project. Heading back to the main page of the Messenger, we'll click where it says more local news, and we'll see what waits for us there. Darkness, that's the only thing that Jacob Berube can remember after he was hit by a car while riding a Razor electric scooter. Berube, 23, of Fort Dodge, was on his way home on October 17, 2020 from his dad's house. I fired up my scooter and made my way slowly home, he recalled. By the time I got to the 169 exit ramp, I had a couple of vehicles' headlights that shined from behind. I pulled over to let them pass. One waved at me, and then I was going to the top. As soon as I got to the top, it went all dark. Everything blacked out. Berube was hit from behind by a car driven by James Goodell of Humboldt. The Iowa State Patrol reported the scooter didn't have reflectors. Goodell came up the ramp behind Berube and didn't see him, according to the State Patrol. The crash was reported at 9:28 p.m. Berube suffered serious injuries to his legs. He eventually was airlifted to a Des Moines hospital. The only thing I remember is waking up in the hospital with vision more fuzzy, he said. I had no clue what was going on. I looked at my legs and they were covered in cast, and I wondered if this was a dream. I had no memory of what happened during that time. The only thing I can truly remember, it was pitch black. Before I blacked out, I don't remember seeing any kind of headlights at all. Berube said he chose to ride the scooter because the trails nearby were closed at the time. He said the scooter was only his mode of transportation. Berube's grandma, Becky Hansen, recalled watching Life Flight fly over her Fort Dodge home the night of the crash. At that time, she had no idea it was her grandson and the helicopter up above. My daughter called me that Sunday and she said, "Are you sitting down?" and that I needed to sit down, Hansen recalled. She said Jacob was hit by a car. We could have lost him very easily. They said he lost a lot of blood. Hansen believes a quick response saved her grandchild. I am glad the gentleman that did hit him stopped because that's probably what saved him. Hansen said Fort Dodge firefighters working the red shift told her Berube could have lost his legs. She said doctors weren't sure if he would be able to walk again. But about 3 weeks ago, Berube got up out of his wheelchair at Walmart and started walking toward Hansen. I heard something and turned to see what it was, Hansen said. He had those boots on and was walking toward me. I am going, "Oh my gosh, you're walking." He said, "Yeah, I had to prove them wrong. He was walking toward me and I'm crying, of course." We hugged and I told him he's doing a great job. After several surgeries and multiple physical therapy sessions, Berube is slowly but surely gaining strength back in his legs. He has been walking with the assistance of crutches, sometimes just one. His left leg had more severe injuries. "Since Tuesday, I saw him walking without crutches," Hansen said. "He went out and got himself some real nice tennis shoes. It's just an overwhelming feeling. When I saw him with his legs all wrapped up and painful, he went through a lot of pain. That hurts to watch your grandchild hurt." Berube continues to push himself during physical therapy, which he goes to twice a week at E3 Millennium Therapy Services in Fort Dodge. "So far, I'm healing up pretty good," Berube said. "They were quite surprised I was able to recover from such a devastating accident. This tested my determination and how much I can push myself. From here on out, I still feel determination to recover more and more by the day." Berube also thinks his backpack helped him absorb some of the impact of the crash. "I always carry a backpack on me no matter where I travel," he said. "My backpack took the heaviest hit of all, so it protected me. Getting hit at 45 miles per hour, the backpack took some of the hit. They were surprised there was no heavy trauma to the head." Throughout the process, Berube is thankful for his family's support. "I would like to tell people all around, if you've ever been in a situation where you think all hope is gone, stay determined," he said. "Family, love, and support will hit you harder and you will feel it all the way through recovery. I was lucky enough to be alive and my family was happy to see me." Heading back to the main page of the Messenger, we'll take a look at our next article. New cases and positivity rate is down significantly from the end of 2020 rates. Though the death toll has increased, Webster County Health Department data over the last 2 weeks has shown progress with new COVID-19 cases and positivity rates down significantly from the last 2 months of 2020. As of Thursday, Webster County's positivity rate was 5%, with 36% people rather under public health isolation. From February 12th to Thursday, a total of 49 cases were diagnosed. The highest daily increase was 13 cases. The lowest was 3 cases. For public health, those numbers seem to be part of a downward trend seen over the last 2 months. A welcome relief after many single days with exponentially higher case numbers than the recent 2-week total. We started to see the beginning of the downward trend in cases around the end of 2020, and it has continued into 2021, said Kelly Bloomquist, Webster County Public Health Information Officer. We are still seeing positive COVID tests and exposures, but not to the extent that we were seeing in September, October, and November. As long as the public continues to wear masks, social distance, and stay home while sick, Bloomquist believes the trend will continue, particularly as more become vaccinated. As of Thursday, Webster County had accumulated 4,904 cases since the pandemic began. The death toll has gone from 64 to 86 in less than 2 months since New Year's Day, though some deaths may have occurred before January 1st. Since Iowa Department of Public Health reporting typically has a delay of up to a week between a death and its reflection in data. For 72 of the deaths, 84%, COVID-19 itself was the direct cause. Since spikes in November that prompted alarm among public health and hospital officials, total cases have slowed. November 7th, there were 2,274 cases. December 5th, 4,211. December 19th, 4,498. January 1st, 4,755. February, 4,904. The 14-day positivity rate that spiraled out of control in the fall is also showing significant progress. This marker indicates the proportion of those tested who received positive results. On November 7th, 21%, December 5th, 20.1%, December 19th, 16.1%, January 1st, 13.7%, February 25th, 5%. The decrease can be attributed to many things, including an increase in mask wearing, social distancing, staying home when you're sick, and the availability of testing and now vaccinations, the understanding of quarantine guidance, and the adaptation of people's behaviors that once may have increased the passing of germs, said Bloomquist. Webster County passed a public mask mandate on December 22nd, bringing the entire county in line with a similar mask mandate passed by the Fort Dodge City Council on November 23rd. Though the city mask mandate has since expired, the county's remains in effect. As of Thursday, 7,164 vaccine doses have been administered in the county, roughly 60% of them from Moderna. Heading back to the Messenger website, we'll take a look at the news of record for February 26. Police reports from Wednesday indicate 2 domestic calls being reported. An assault, 1200 block South 22nd Street. A fight, 900 block 1st Avenue North. Suspicious vehicle, 3rd Avenue North, North 20th Street. Car accident, 1000 block Williams Drive. Suspicious person, South 12th Street and 4th Avenue South. Car accident, 10 block North 25th Street. Harassment, 300 block South 9th Street. Missing juvenile, 2600 block 5th Avenue South. Harassment, 300 block South 9th Street. Car accident, 1600 block 12th Avenue Southwest. Car accident, North 8th Street, Central Avenue. Juvenile problems, 2800 block 5th Avenue South. Runaway, 300 block Avenue M West. Car accident, A Street and Avenue B. Theft, 200 block North 16th Street. Suspicious person, 3100 block North 15th Street. Shots fired, 2900 block of 7th Avenue South. Thursday, Magistrate Court, violation of probation, Harold Powell III, 22 of Fort Dodge, probation revocation hearing set for March 22nd. third-degree criminal mischief and disorderly conduct. Ashley Yeomans, 35, of Marshalltown. Preliminary hearing waived on the mischief charge and disorderly conduct has been continued for 180 days. No insurance in an accident. Brett Scherzan of Fort Dodge fined $801.75. That is the report of the news of record. An Estherville man who distributed methamphetamine in the Lakes area was sentenced Tuesday to 7 years in federal prison, according to a news release from the Assistant U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Iowa. Lance Jacob Wetter, 26, received the term after a September 22nd guilty plea to one count of conspiracy to distribute meth within 1,000 feet of a protected location. In the plea agreement, he and others admitted to distributing in the Lakes area from October 19th to February 2020. Wetter sold 2 ounces of meth to an undercover officer at the public library in Spirit Lake and another 2 ounces at his apartment, which was within 1,000 feet of Memorial Park in Spirit Lake. Following his prison term, he must serve a 7-year term of supervised release. The case was prosecuted by the Assistant U.S. Attorney Michaela Steenholt, who investigated by the Tri-State Drug Task Force based in Sioux City, which consists of law enforcement personnel from the Drug Enforcement Administration, Sioux City Police Department, Homeland Security Investigations, Woodbury County Sheriff's Office, South Sioux City, Nebraska Police Department, Nebraska State Patrol, Iowa National Guard, Iowa Division of Narcotics Enforcement, the United States Marshals Service, South Dakota Division of Criminal Investigation, and the Woodbury County Attorney's Office. Heading back to the main page of the Messenger, taking a look at from our files over the past couple days. There is a picture in the paper recently, Camelia Laubaugh, who turned 14 on February 26, 2006, was named Miss Black Fort Dodge in ceremonies at the Fort Museum Opera House. As friends and family took photos, her mother, Amita Laubaugh, came up behind her to hug her. Take a look quick and see if there's something else from our files that I didn't quite get to. I think we're all caught up. Take a look next at the lifestyle section. And I'll take a look and see if there are any recent arrivals to tell you about. From Unity Point Trinity Regional Medical Center, Anna Brondike, a girl, born February 19th. Holly and Jason Smith of Goldfield, a boy, born February 22nd. Samantha and Jacob Bartson of Fort Dodge, a girl, born February 23rd. Chloe Duckett, a boy, born February 23rd. From Iowa Specialty Hospital, Maria and Hunter McNeese of Britt welcomed a girl, Lenora Ann McNeese, born February 19th. Grandparents are Brent and Kim McNeese. Chuck and Julie Mullen, great-grandparents are Ron and Becky Howing, Gail McNeese, Barb Jones, and Mike. And that is all the recent arrivals at Trinity Regional Medical Center and the Iowa Specialty Hospital. Take a look next at birthdays and anniversaries. Bob and Janet Singer celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary on February 27th. Their family includes 3 children and 6 grandchildren. Janet Betts and Robert Singer were married February 27th, 1971 in Orillia. And that is the only anniversary or birthday to tell you about in this week's newspaper. You're listening to the Fort Dodge Messenger on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Service for the Blind. And now we will take a look at today's obituary page. Ruth Peterson. On February 20th, 2021, Ruth Elaine Peterson passed away on the family Century Farm at the age of 88. She was reunited with her husband in heaven because as a young girl, she accepted Christ as her Savior. Ruth was born to Reverend George and Frieda Haynes Bates in Ohio, August 22, 1932. She was the eldest of four children. Ruth lived in Cleveland, Ohio most of her childhood until her senior year in high school when they moved to Decatur, Illinois. She graduated mid-year from Decatur High School in 1948. That fall, she attended Wheaton College, where she would receive her nursing diploma. Ruth attended Baptist Bible Seminary. It was there that she would meet the love of her life, Richard Peterson, with the purple and white Ford. They were married August 23, 1957. Last year was their 63rd wedding anniversary. No matter what they faced in their life together, their faith and trust in God never wavered. Richard and Ruth started their family in Windsor, New York, with the births of Greg and Heidi. Her work included nursing, church, and teaching piano. Ruth had always loved animals. They had a pet dog named Pal that was part of the family. In August 1969, the family moved to the Peterson family farm near Burnside. In 1976, Richard and Ruth chose to add Jay Edward to their family. Richard and Ruth did many things together, from daily chores to traveling. She worked part-time as a night nursing survivor at Trinity Regional Hospital for many years. Greg and Cheryl, Heidi, Jay, and Kim were eventually joined by 13 grandchildren and 13 great-grandchildren. Ruth was preceded in death by her husband Richard, parents George and Frieda Bates, and grandson Carl Wesley. All services will be held at Gunderson Funeral Home. Visitation is Friday from 4 to 7 p.m. The service will be Saturday, March 6th at 10 a.m. Howard Borman. From Algona, a private mass for Howard Borman will be 2 o'clock at St. Joseph Catholic Church at St. Joseph. Visitation is 5 to 7. March 1st at Lent's Funeral Home. From Palmer, Bernard Kritz. Bernard Kritz, 92, died at his home in Palmer Thursday, February 25th. Services are pending at Larson Weishauer Funeral Home in Manson. Anna Miller. Anna Catherine Miller, 91, of Manson, died Thursday, February 25th at the Paula J. Baber Hospice Home. Family services will be held Monday at St. Thomas Catholic Church in Manson, with visitation at the church prior to the service. Anna is survived by her children, Patricia and Thomas Ledford, Andrew, Michael, and Rachel Miller, Martha and Bernie Abul, Jane and Steve Lawler, Joseph Miller, half-brothers Richard Mossback, Edward Mossback, 14 grandchildren, 17 great-grandchildren, with two more expected this year. She is preceded in death by her husband, parents, and grandparents. Anna Catherine Miller was born October 23, 1929, to Joseph and Martha Angel Mossback. Anna's mother passed away 8 days after she was born. She was raised and educated, she was raised by her grandparents, Jacob and Catherine Bates Angel. Anna grew up in the Manson area and graduated from Manson High School in 1948. She married Andrew Robert Miller on January 15, 1951 at St. Thomas Catholic Church. Together they raised 5 children. In her younger years, she worked at the Manson State Bank but spent the majority of her life as a mother, homemaker, and helped on the farm. Anna enjoyed spending time with her grandchildren and great-grandchildren, as well as cooking and baking for her family. Anna was a member of the St. Thomas Women's Guild. Larson Weishauer Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. From Eagle Grove, Michael Dorneth. Services for Michael Dorneth, 60, of Eagle Grove, will be at 2 o'clock on March 4th at Faust Funeral Home in Eagle Grove. Visitation is March 3rd from 5 to 7 at the funeral home. Ray Stanley. Ray Stanley, 81, of Fort Dodge, died Wednesday, February 24th at Unity Point Health Trinity Regional Medical Center in Fort Dodge. Funeral services were held on Saturday, February 27th at First Presbyterian Church. Entombment was in the Chapel of Peace Mausoleum at Northlawn Cemetery. Raymond Edward Stanley, the son of Alva and Violet Henderson Stanley, was born December 13, 1939 in Aiken, Minnesota. Ray graduated from Fort Dodge Senior High and then moved to St. Paul, Minnesota. He graduated from the University of Minnesota with a BA in Medical Technology. Ray worked at Trinity Regional Medical Center in Fort Dodge during high school, where he did janitorial work and served as an orderly and drove ambulance. On June 19, 1959, Ray married Doreen Beach. The couple later divorced. Ray was rehired at Trinity Regional Medical Center on April 23, 1962, and retired as the manager of the laboratory, material management, and information services on April 23, 1999, after a total of 40 years of faithful service. On March 5, 1982, Ray married Jean Alberts, and together they made their home in Fort Dodge and also at their cabin home at Spirit Lake. Ray taught at night at Iowa Central Community College as their laboratory instructor for the medical assistant program for 20 years, from 1964 to 1984. Ray was an active member of First Presbyterian Church. He was an ordained elder, member of the church session, an elder for Kids Zone Daycare. He also served on the church property and finance ministry team. Ray volunteered at wheelchair ministry, participated in international mission trips, and was a volunteer at the Presbyterian camp on Okoboji. He was a board member at Lakeshore Center and served as interim administrator of the Presbyterian camp in 2006. He was also the project manager for the Lakeshore Retreat Center from 2007 and 2008. Ray was a past president and treasurer of the Fort Dodge Swim Club and a former board member of the YMCA. He is survived by his wife Jean, his three sons Mark and Joan Stanley, Murray and Stacy Stanley, Michael and Gretchen Stanley, his stepson David Alberts, 10 grandchildren, Chelsea, Nick, Zach, Alex, Taylor, and Ryan Stanley, Samantha Brown, Noah Stanley, Christian Stanley, Marita Alberts, along with 12 great-grandchildren. Ray is preceded in death by his parents. Memorials may be left to the discretion of the family. From Johnston, Janet Anderson. Janet Anderson, 79, died February 23rd at Mercy Hospital in Des Moines. She was born September 22, 1941 in Gallery, where she grew up on a farm, driving tractors and shucking corn. She graduated from Harcourt High School, where she played basketball. She became a devoted mother and later a single mother who was committed to taking care of her children. She took in her grandson David as one of her own. Janet was employed for over 27 years by Kentucky Fried Chicken, where she was promoted to manager. In her free time, she enjoyed watching football, basketball, track, NASCAR, Law and Order, and NCIS. She loved the music of Garth Brooks and Shania Twain. She will be remembered for her love of plants and animals and her great sense of humor. Janet was a caring, loving person and will be deeply missed by family, friends, and co-workers. She was preceded in death by her parents, Carl and Mildred Van Hoff, a brother, Sonny H. Donald, and grandson, Matthew Samblum, one sister, Joan Nichols, a daughter, Janelle Hubert. She is survived by her sons, Steve and Lori Anderson, and Brian Anderson, siblings, Darlene Lumberg, Carolyn Lee, Dennis Van Hoff, Donna Shady, 7 grandchildren, 6 great-grandchildren. A service was held on February 27th at the Creekside Church in Urbandale. Caldwell Parish Funeral Home was in charge of arrangements. Daniel McLeod. Daniel W. McLeod, 85, of Winder, Georgia, formerly of Fort Dodge, died Thursday, February 25th in Winder. Services are pending at Laufesweiler Funeral Home. From Clarion, Lynette Bopst. Lynette C. Bopst, 85, of Clarion, died Wednesday, February 24th at Clarion Wellness and Rehabilitation Center. Ewing Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. And that is the extent of today's obituary page. Going to take another look at from our files. This is from February 27th, going back to 2006. There's a picture of students Tomomi Sakata and Rai Murakami as they show items from their native Japan at the 2006 Focus International Fair Sunday at Iowa Central Community College. The event was the brainchild of longtime Iowa Central faculty member Mary Sula Lenny, who died February 25th, 2006. And that's another section from our files. That was February 27th, 2006. Farm Bureau agent Leslie Caldwell received the 2020 All-American Award and Hall of Fame honor. The prestigious honor recognizes Caldwell's dedication to serving the community. It's the 10th time she has received this honor. She previously earned a $1 million round table. Caldwell has been an agent with Farm Bureau Financial Services for 15 years. Shannon Armstrong, Director of Safety for Decker Truck Line, recently received her Certified Director of Safety certification from North American Transportation Management Institute. The certificate was created by the University of Central Florida. NATMI exists to improve the performance and productivity of the professionals directly responsible for effective fleet and driver performance. Risk managers, safety and security directors, maintenance managers, and commercial driver trainers. The CDS training and certification program is outcome-focused and utilizes rigorous instructional design standards. Outcome-focused means that the process, structure, and content of the program is focused on the desired outcomes, including reduced accidents and injuries, lower vehicle maintenance costs, improved driver retention, improved operational efficiency, and better management systems. The requirements to this certification include 4+ years in the motor fleet safety field, 4-year college degree, and candidates must serve as full-time administrators, demonstrating their capability of handling a position which involves establishing programs and policies, setting standards, developing materials, and providing leadership to achieve the goals set. Armstrong, a Fort Dodge native, is a graduate of the University of Northern Iowa. She earned a Bachelor and Master of Arts degree in English, Language, and Literature. In March 2013, she joined Decker as a track accident specialist. In June of 2015, she was promoted to Safety Coordinator. In January 2020, Armstrong was appointed to Director of Safety. In this role, she manages the functions of safety, workman's compensation, compliance, and claims handling, as well as other safety-related issues. Take a look at today's Messenger editorial page. Enjoy the Progress Agriculture section is the title of the Messenger editorial. The annual Progress edition wraps up with the Agriculture section in today's edition of the Messenger. It provides a comprehensive look at how a wide array of developments in our region are shaping the agriculture tomorrow. While every issue of this newspaper is filled with articles, features, and advertisements that readers find informative and useful, the special section we call Progress provides a perspective that goes far beyond simply reporting the latest happenings. Our goal is to look at the big picture, capture trends, and explore more fully events that may lead to headlines down the road. Agriculture has shaped the economy not only of North Central Iowa, but also the entire Hawkeye State. For more than a century and a half, it remains a huge factor in 2021 and is the focus of the Progress section included with this issue of the newspaper. The Progress articles will help readers understand the agricultural industry more fully, but also included our stories touching on many other aspects of farm life and the farm economy. Perusing the Messenger may take a bit longer than usual today. We hope, however, that you will regard the time spent reading this hefty issue to be a worthwhile investment in learning more about agriculture in Iowa. The 21st century can be a prosperous time for the rural Iowa economy and an era of exciting renewal for many north central Iowa communities. The days ahead are full of promise. Today's Messenger editorial. We'll take a look next at the Messenger sports page. It's been both enjoyable and educational to help Fort Dodge senior high football coach Nick Mosier and his staff honor Fort Dodge former Dodger athletes on social media throughout February for Black History Month. Mosier contacted me last month to see if I would be willing to lend a hand. Being a local sports history wonk, I was ready to start digging through the archives immediately. Many of the stories I knew, I've been watching games at Dodger Stadium for well over 30 years. A lot of the late 80s football players he wanted to recognize, Antonio Love, Charles Bodaddy, Joe Crooks, Jeremy Williams, were almost mythical figures to me, given my age and level of fandom. By the time I reached high school, athletes like Alonzo Clayton and Mike Mosley were making headlines as I passed them in the halls. Quinnell McCaleb graduated with my sister. I could name quite a few others who I still call friends to this day. When I became sports editor in 2000, it opened the door to covering and getting to know many of the players firsthand. Curtis Taylor, Montario Poe, Jontel Clayton, Darius Kasten, Willie Williams, Caden Preston, Trey Mosley, Tyson Kershaw, all terrific players and even better people. I learned a lot during this project too when we tabbed Bill Goodman, a Fort Dodge Senior High Hall of Fame inductee of 2016. I found out he was one of just two black students in his graduating class of 1965 of 450 people. Talk about a trailblazer. Goodman was a multi-sport standout who was drafted by the Cincinnati Reds, played minor league baseball for 7 years, became a teacher, and later a successful businessman in the Twin Cities area. I'd always heard of Sam Mosley's legendary performances and physique when Bob Brown and I would sit around the office and occasionally reminisce nearly 20 years ago. He reminded me that Sam was the best pure athlete to ever come out of this community, bar none. Mosley was a dominant athlete on the basketball court, especially averaging over 20 points per game and garnering All-State status twice for the Dodgers. He became a standout player at the University of Nevada and averaging a double-double during his senior year as the Wolfpack took the conference championship. In 1984, Mosley was selected by the Phoenix Suns in the fourth round. What many people don't know is that Seattle also picked him in the 12th round of the NFL draft. I'm still working on getting Sam to commit to a feature story and revisit all this in the not-so-distant future. The Thedford brothers, Ken and Mike, were standout running backs in the 80s. Their work holds up, as both still rank in the top 10 all-time for rushing yards in the program history. I was first introduced to Willie Thornton as Webster Des Moines Valley's varsity basketball coach, but in 1983, Thornton was a quarterback and all-state defensive back for the Dodgers. I met Tim Mosley 4 years ago during his senior high Hall of Fame induction. Tim was an all-state wide receiver who became a star wideout and punter at the University of Northern Iowa. He eventually signed an NFL contract with the Denver Broncos. Harold Lewis and Bill Grady were new to me relative to the other names. Lewis earned his first team all-state status as a Dodger defensive lineman in 1976. Grady, the 1979 squad's leading rusher, scored a school record 5 touchdowns in 1 game and garnered All-State status as well. So I brushed up on the statistics and became well-versed in the records and accomplishments. That much was a given. What I quickly realized, judging by the daily reactions on social media to the posts about each athlete, was just how many lives each of them touched in their own special way. Of course, they were role models to younger black students in Fort Dodge. It extended way beyond that, though. This wasn't just about making an all-state list or being in the record books. It was the way their friends, teachers, and other community members remember them. Still to this day, the kind of Dodgers you'd want your kid to emulate, both on and off, more importantly, the field. Coach Mosier felt this process was most important and long overdue. These men have played a critical role in developing the roots and personality of Fort Dodge Senior High football throughout the decades. Above all else, they deserve to be recognized as true leaders and memorable people. We honor them for Black History Month because it's an appropriate gesture. But first and foremost, the spotlight shines on them for today for the heart, soul, and character they displayed during their times as citizens of Fort Dodge. And that is a column written by Eric Pratt, who is the sports editor for the Fort Dodge Messenger. Heading back to the main page of the sports section, Deegan Hepp has been riding his motorcycle since he was little. All the hard work is starting to pay off. Hepp, along with a large group of other Fort Dodge and area riders, has been competing at the Hoosier Arena Cross Nationals. The Fort Dodge Senior High senior and Fort Dodge's Zane Rando are currently second in the point standings for their respective age groups. "I've had an awesome time racing Hoosier Arena Cross," he said. "Coming in six rounds late and still being in second in points feels really good. I can't wait to bump up to the A class for next year." Hap, who has been training with Fort Dodge graduate Isaiah Clark and Fort Dodge native Taylor Graw in Oklahoma, has had a perfect run in the college boys age 15 to 24 division. "We have been training a lot together," Hep said. "We will be heading home this weekend." Hep has won 16 motos in 8 of the races he has competed in, collecting 250 points. Brennan Wages of Illinois is sitting in first place with 361 points. The 18-year-old also competes in the 250B and 450B classes. He is currently fifth with 7 podiums and 2 wins in 250B. He also has 1 win in 450B. "Racing arena cross takes patience. You can't make any dumb moves," Hep said. "Good starts are always key to getting wins." Rando is currently second in the points in the schoolboy age 12 to 16 division. He has 4 podiums, meaning first through third, and 2 victories with 207 points. Jalen McManus of Topeka, Kansas is the leader with 302 points. Randall is also 4th in the 125 All-Stars and 5th in 250C. He has 4 podiums in combined with 1 win in 2 classes. Fort Dodge's Taj Lowry has 2 podiums in the 250C and also competes in 450C. Ohio native Devin Sullivan is 7th in college boy. Sullivan, who also races 450B, has 1 podium and competes in the Open Outlaw Non-Pro with a podium. Tyson Clayton has a victory in the 7 to 9-year-old senior division. Fort Dodge's Cody Rodenborn is 13th in the 30 amateur point standings with 1 victory. Michael White of Gowrie has raced in the Vet 25 amateur. Hoosier Arena Cross Nationals will wrap up this season in Tunica, Mississippi for the World Championships this weekend. The race will be worth double points. Caden Madsen baked home a shot from around the free throw line as time expired Thursday night, pushing Humboldt into a Class A 3A substate final with a dramatic 71-69 victory over North Central Conference rival Algona. Madsen, a junior, finished with 14 points for the Wildcats. We're 15-7 overall. His heroics came off of a turnover. Humboldt now faces Clear Lake on Tuesday in Algona for a Class 3A tournament berth. The Lions are 21-2 overall. The conference foes split the regular season series. Tip time is set for 7 o'clock. Taking a quick look next at the tournament pairings, the only schools really in the Fort Dodge area in the state tournament for girls is Algona Bishop Garrigan. They are the number one seed in the Class 1A tournament, and they open up against Springville at 2 o'clock on Wednesday, March 3rd. Newell Fonda is the number 2 seed. They are 23-1 on the season. They play their quarterfinal game at 6 o'clock Wednesday, March 3rd against Kingsley Pearson. And I was interested to note that of these teams, of the 8 teams in Class 1A, there are only 11 losses between the 8 teams. And so it's going to be a very competitive girls basketball tournament that starts this week in Des Moines on Monday. And those games begin at 9 o'clock on Monday with the 5A quarterfinals. Let's go ahead and take a look at the weather forecast for the next 10 days or so. We'll take a quick look at the 10-day forecast. Sunshine will be dominant over the next 7 days or so. Only a high of 32 on Monday under sunny skies, then warming up to 49 on Tuesday, Wednesday 51, Thursday, high of 50, Friday, high of 49, high on Saturday of 51 degrees under mostly or partly sunny skies during that time. Clouds come in on Sunday, but we'll have a high temperature of 54, 55 on Monday, 57 on Tuesday. For the most part, lows at night will be in the upper 20s to the mid 30s. And so the forecast sounds pretty good. There's no sign of any precipitation over the next 10 days. That's going to bring us to the end of the reading of today's Fort Dodge Messenger. Well, I should say the messenger from Friday the 26th and Saturday the 27th. I'm Kevin Rogers at the microphone. Thank you so much for spending this time with me. Of course, this podcast and many others are available at the iowaradioreading.org website, and we hope that you enjoy the podcasts that are made available to you. Thank you for joining me to read the Fort Dodge Messenger on the Iowa Radio Information Service for the Blind. Stay safe, stay healthy. Easier to stay warm now that the temperatures have come up just a little bit. And we'll talk to you again real soon. Bye-bye for now.